Presidential primary season is just around the corner. Every candidate is pulling out the stops in order to win over voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, and beyond.
From press conferences to photo opportunities, crafting sound bites to reaching out on social media, the campaign spin machine is in full effect.
Political spin is something that's widely known about, often looked down on. According to our next guest, spin wasn't created with cable TV and sound bites. It's been around since the days of Teddy Roosevelt. In fact, might even be necessary in a democratic government like ours.
Joining us now is David Greenberg, an associate professor of history and journalism at Rutgers University. His latest book is called Republic of Spin, an Inside History of the American Presidency. David, thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Well, we hear the word spin a lot when it comes to the world of politics, but can you define it for us? What is spin?
Sure. I mean, I use it in my book, Republic of Spin, to refer to the whole cluster of tools and techniques and practices that politicians have built up over the last 100 or more years for shaping their message, shaping their images, shaping public opinion. Spin really has come to mean a phenomenon, a feature of our political life and our political communication.
So by that definition, you said it goes back 100 years. What is one or two of the earliest examples of spin being used?
Right. Well, I say it goes back 100 years. In some sense, of course, spin is inherent in politics. The ancient Greeks talked about rhetoric, you know, which was sort of their synonym for their version of spin. So in some sense, it's always been with us. What happens at the start of the 20th century are two things. In the presidency, Theodore Roosevelt realizes that to make the president a seat of activism, where he's going to set the agenda rather than Congress, he's got to go out to public opinion and use all the tools he has to persuade the public to back him. At the same time, you have candidates for the very first time starting to campaign personally for president and make their case themselves. William Jennings Bryan, to some degree William McKinley in the 1896 election. So both candidates and presidents are going out to the public to make their case, and to do that, they're using the new mass media, mass circulation, newspapers, even film, newsreels. McKinley makes the first campaign film. Radio is soon available to them. So it's that whole set of instruments that they can now use to affect the public thinking.
So some of that, those early examples you just gave, it sounds like par for the course. It's persuasion, which is what any politician would do. But these days, it seems like it's also just equated with lying.
Right. Well, I think there's always an element in all political communication where there's some distrust of what politicians say. And so what happens is the names that we give to the phenomenon starts to take on unsavory associations. For example, propaganda. You know, in Roosevelt's day, they called it propaganda. But soon after World War I, that kind of took on negative connotations. So people started searching for other words. In our own time, we've been using the word spin for a few decades now. I think it suggests not so much lying, but putting your best slant on the information, ideally stopping short of lying. You know, after the debates, they go to the spin room, or what used to be called spin alley, and we hear the candidate surrogates kind of making their best case for why their guy won. Maybe it's sincere, maybe it's not, maybe it's persuasive, maybe it's not. But the audience understands that there's kind of a game going on. There's a playful dimension to spin. Spin has a sense of fun about it. We can see through spin, you know. We can applaud spin when it's in the service of an argument or a candidate that we like. So it really means a lot more than lying or deception. Spin can be used for misleading, but it can also be used for leading.
Well, let's talk about some of those more famous examples of spin. Who are some of the presidents who are most effective at this, at using spin to get their message out and to reach voters?
Well, one thing I discovered in researching the history of spin, and I go back, look at all these presidents and also kind of these unsung spin doctors who often behind the scenes were really innovating with these presidents. Those who we remember as successful at spin tend to be the ones who we remember as successful presidents. That is, you know, you can't be a successful spinner without successful policies. Effective spin, what it does is it presents the policies in an appealing way to the public. But, you know, give you an example. Herbert Hoover in 1928, when he ran for president, was considered a genius with publicity. He made sort of this epic campaign film called Master of Emergencies that showed him, you know, saving Europe after World War I because he was the food czar for feeding a hungry Europe. It showed him saving people along the Mississippi after the 1927 flood when, as Commerce Secretary, he was in charge of the rescue and relief mission. But once the Depression hit, Hoover was not such a master of emergencies, and he didn't have solutions to finding work for people, finding food for people. He tried to turn to his spin doctors. He brought in Edward Bernays, one of the leading public relations men of the day, and put him on a committee. And at a certain point, Bernays says, look, I'm not a magician. You need a jobs program, essentially. That spin isn't going to help you if you don't have good policies. So it's no coincidence that the presidents who tend to be remembered as successful at spin, whether that's Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Kennedy, Reagan, Clinton, tend to be ones who have something to show for themselves in the area of achievement.
We're talking to David Greenberg right now, author of the new book, Republic of Spin. He's taking us through the history of political spin, and we're going to get to how it's being used in this election cycle. And you mentioned Ronald Reagan. Now, he's known as being the great communicator. Was he an innovator when it came to this kind of communication, this kind of technique?
Well, one point I make in the book is that Reagan was not sort of the groundbreaking figure that people often think of him as being. Yes, he came out of Hollywood. He had a background in radio as a broadcaster, a background in television with GE, a background in movies. So he was practiced in sort of all the arts of mass communication. But the methods of spin that he used were ones that had been developed by, you know, a century of his forebears, of Richard Nixon, used a lot of the same focus on getting his image of the day out there, his line of the day out there, although Reagan's the one we remember for having done that. So Reagan certainly was skilled at it, but he was building on what many others had done. The other interesting thing that we forget about Reagan is that he was a great communicator except when he wasn't. And when Reagan spoke off the cuff, often in debates or at press conferences, he was often out of his depth, and he would be savaged by the press. He didn't have good recall of facts. He would throw out facts that were just untrue, that were pulled from somewhere in kind of the back of his mind, this wellspring of myths and stories that he liked to tell. And so at a certain point, his aides really kept him tightly wedded to a script when he could be very effective in his delivery. But he was only a great communicator under very limited circumstances.
Now, looking at where we are today, the media landscape, you know, you've got Far Beyond Radio, which was an innovation. You've got social media. You've got cable TV. You've got Twitter. Does stuff like that diminish the power of a president and the power of a president to spin things, or does it amplify it?
Well, I think what happens is with each step, with each technological innovation, there's a sort of learning process by which presidents and their aides sort of scramble to figure out how to make the best use of it. And clearly we saw kind of faltering steps with social media until in the 2008 campaign, Obama really proved himself to be very successful with it. But then, too, he's kind of run into the limits of that he finds that it's not a substitute for having what presidents like Eisenhower and Kennedy had, which was the ability to commandeer the big three national networks to give a speech from the Oval Office that everyone's going to listen to.
And we've got the Iowa primary coming up right around the corner. Have you noticed, as you think about this for your book, have you noticed candidates standing out when it comes to their spin strategies, their communication strategies?
Well, I mean, you know, there's different dimensions of it. For some, it's how they use technology. I mean, Donald Trump takes to Twitter and gives these sort of off-the-cuff reactions that seem to sort of delight the many members of the news media who follow him. That seems to at least partly play into the ride that he's been getting. For others, the spin centers on kind of keeping it under wraps, portraying themselves as completely authentic without handlers. So Bernie Sanders, you know, strikes people as, oh, he's just a guy who rolled out of bed and is delivering his speech. But, you know, people were circulating this new Simon and Garfunkel ad. Well, that was made by some pretty sophisticated spin doctors there. Or, you know, who are his pollsters? Who are his managers who are kind of devising these lines and strategies that have worked well to him? You know, this he's got a spin operation, too. He's just followed the strategy of keeping it behind the scenes.
Well, do you think people like that strategy when they don't want to see sort of the puppet strings behind? Or do you think they want a candidate to be up front and say, yes, I've got a team and I'm sophisticated at this. I know what I'm doing. Which one resonates more with voters today?
I think voters like the illusion that there is no spin. They like the illusion of a candidate who is somehow, you know, completely pure, completely authentic, true to himself. But one thing I noticed in the research is, you know, and I go back, this is true of Eisenhower, Truman, Calvin Coolidge, these were all politicians who had a persona of being very natural, untutored, unprepossessing. Each and every one of them worked with coaches, worked with advertising men to sort of refine that persona. A good example is Harry Truman. You know, we think of him as this kind of salt-of-the-earth guy who just sort of said what he thought. Well, his delivery, the way he delivered his speech was initially seen as quite, you know, poor. And he went into the broadcast studio with a broadcast coach named Leonard Reinsch, who really trained him a lot. So by the time his convention speech came around in the 1948 campaign, Truman had perfected the ad-lib style, which sounded ad-lib and perfectly natural, but in fact was the result of much coaching and practice. So whenever we see an authentic candidate, it doesn't mean that there isn't something real about them, but it does mean that they've worked on refining this appearance.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
That was David Greenberg, author of the new book. It's called Republic of Spin, taking us through the history of political spin there. We talked a little bit about how it's being used in this election cycle.